Namaste and blessings. Welcome to Meditative Living with Swami Shivanandagiri. Very, very happy to have you along for the ride today, whether you're listening live or in the archives. This is Swami Shivanandagiri, broadcasting live from Region 5 in the United States of America. First off, kindly allow this Swami to thank Sonic Aitchison, who is the one who makes all Type1Radio.com events happen and keeps this Swami sounding as good as possible. Also, another very humble thanks to Thomas Sheridan for sharing the notification of this show on his Facebook. So if you're one of Thomas's friends or foes, welcome along. What we do here, this is, well, what we're engaged in today is episode number 15 in the series covering a book called The Authoritative Guru Gita of His Holiness Mahamandaleshwar Paramahamsa Swarupananda Vishwaguru Maharaj of Los Angeles, California, who is this Swami's guru. And he is also of note because he was the very first white-skinned, American-born human being to be invited into the rank of the Mahamandaleshwars within what is commonly referred to as Hinduism, but more properly referred to as Sanatana Dharma. That word, Sanatana, if you're reading it, looks like Sanatana. Sanatana Dharma, from the ancient times, translated into English, would mean the eternal natural way. So within Sanatana Dharma, there are numerous traditions, lineages, and texts. In what we're doing today, we are covering the work of Acharya Padma Najendra, who is also a disciple of the same guru. She is a Sanskritist, and she took the ancient text called Guru Gita, which would in English mean Song of the Guru, and she translated it into English, a fresh translation, a modern translation. And then there's also commentary by a brother Swami of this Swami. And along with that commentary, you will get this Swami's commentary regarding the text and the subject matter covered. For those unfamiliar with the Guru Gita, this Swami would most humbly request not that you tune away right now, but it would be of great advantage to you to go back to episode 1 and listen to it from the beginning. That would help things make much more sense. But if you are here with us today, live or in the type1radio.com archive, this Swami welcomes you with great love and great respect from the heart of all. And thank you for being exactly who and what you are on this day. Okay, let's pick up the text. Taking off with verse 147. Oh, forgot to tell you. Here's a little explanation of what the Guru Gita is. The Guru Gita is a conversation between Shiva and his wife, Parvati. See, when Parvati married Shiva, he put her through her own sadhana or spiritual practices and only utilized the things most effective for her personally to reach the fully enlightened and liberated state, from which there can be no falling, no degrading. You've done it. You have reached the pure target of human existence, as our tradition holds it. So what was happening at the beginning of the Guru Gita? Shiva was with the Saptarishis, the seven first humans to go through yoga training. Now, this yoga had a lot to do with theory and explanation and all that, as well as the postures and the rest of it. Okay? So, Parvati walks up while Shiva is giving discourse. And she sits at his side and just listens. Then, during a break, she asks Shiva, "What is all this stuff? You didn't say this to me." And she asked, what is the guru? How does a human being become like you, knowing all? And he told her, this is a great question. No one's ever asked me this before. And he launches into what has now become known as the Guru Gita. The entire purpose of it being to explain how the relationship between the guru, meaning only one who is tasked with assisting others to achieve the highest level and the fullness of consciousness itself. Okay? There are a lot of people, unfortunately, even some friends of the Swami, who will say the word guru like they're holding a rat by the tail. Some guru of this and that. Well, that's unfortunate, but this is how people look at this term sometimes. But if this is a path one wishes to travel, the guru is the means by which we become capable of traveling it. And it is the interaction with someone who has already accomplished that which we hope to accomplish that makes it much easier and much faster. So, let us begin with verse number 147. Shiva says to Parvati, the disciple should not utter lies, should not speak unpleasantly, should not speak pridefully, and should not speak too much before the guru. He must always carry out the guru's orders and should abstain from issuing commands of his own. The commentary. In short, a real disciple should remain receptive and understand that as disciple, until such time as they become guru, they are in a subordinate and student position. And this is no different, allowing this Swami to expand here, this is no different than gaining mastery of any other skill in life. If you wish to play the guitar like whomever your favorite guitarist is, you should probably go sit with them and let them teach you and show you what they have learned. And perhaps you will come to a point where you can play, not copying them, but inspired by what they've taught you, play it your own way and achieve what they achieve, something similar, okay? So the mastery of a subject, of a practice, of an education, any number of things, art, if you don't have that direct interaction with someone capable of assisting you to go further than you thought was even possible, it's unlikely that you will reach your full potential. It is still possible, of course, but this is the process of working with a guru. Verse 148, Shiva said to Parvati, the disciple should address the guru in such terms as, O Lord, O King, verily, the God residing in the temple. He should move about with fear in the presence of the guru. Now, the commentary. This verse reminds me of a story I once heard Swami Shankarananda from Australia share about Swami Muktananda, who was both his and our Guruji's guru. Swami Muktananda Swami Shankarananda related. The first time I saw Swami Muktananda was in Delhi in February 1971. He was giving programs in a large tent on the lawn of a big estate. He sat like a king on his throne and drew everyone's attention to him. I recognized him as the Lord of the Shakti Chakra, although I did not have that terminology then. This impression was heightened by two vigorous and intelligent young men, Markandeya and Professor Jain, clad in orange, who attended to him. Baba, this was Swami Muktananda's nickname, so to speak. Baba refers to the word father, so it's a very respectful thing to call someone. Baba would beckon one of them, who would quickly come to his side. Baba would whisper something in his ear, and the disciple would be off, running across the ground with great intensity of purpose. Though Baba's manner was simple, matter of fact, and often slightly amused, no one I had ever seen was so much at the center of his own universe and had so much command without effort. Going back to Swami Anantananda's commentary. When I asked Guruji, speaking of our guru, if he had any memories featuring Muktananda as a king-like figure, he said, Baba always looked regal on his chair, like a king on a throne. I remember one time they were taking photos of him. He was really dressed quite spectacularly. He was wearing ochre-colored robes and a peach-colored silk vest. They had him lit with blue light. I remember looking at him and being in just utter bliss. You could just see the Shakti radiating off of him. He looked like a king. Any siddha, the word siddha means a perfected one. Any siddha is a Raja Guru, which means a king of gurus. He is the top of the chain of gurus and capable of enlightening people just by a look or a touch or a word. I remember going through one of Baba's books and finding a picture of a silver throne studded with jewels. I asked one of the swamis who was there at the time about it. She said that a devotee had given it to Baba in India and that Baba had sat on that throne only one time. He sat in it just one time, wearing these great robes so that they could take a picture. Then it went into a room and he never sat on it again. I subsequently found the picture sometime later. He looked quite regal, quite like he belonged there. He was never ostentatious. He would never ride in a Cadillac or a Mercedes. He would ride around everywhere only in an Oldsmobile. He was not like these other gurus who were always in these ostentatious vehicles. So although he was a Maharaj means great king, you could tell that he was not attached, which was a teaching in and of itself. Again, you see that everything the guru does is a teaching to one who is receptive. Every moment the guru makes is a mudra. Every movement the guru makes is a mudra, a teaching. Every word the guru says is a mantra, a teaching. It's okay to be a Maharaj as long as you're not attached. That is the profound teaching. Swami Anantananda continues. I also asked him for his thoughts on the notion that the disciple should move about with fear in the presence of the guru. And he said this. Originally, when Muktananda came to America, there was a small group of us, about 40, who met him at the airport and joined a caravan to take us to the estate of a devotee. Baba used to fix us breakfast back then, before it got to the point where there were thousands of people wherever he went. At the time, I didn't know that the kitchen was upstairs, and I happened to be going upstairs for something from this large, impressive meditation room where we had just finished reciting Guru Gita. I made a turn around the corner and just completely bumped into Baba physically. Baba always walked very quickly, so he was moving fast when this happened. Having read the Guru Gita, knowing that the Guru represents God and is the path to God, knowing the Guru has a fierce side as well as a forgiving side, I knew you don't want to upset the Guru. I was so new then that I didn't know what would upset him and what wouldn't. So I just pranamed, which means bowed, to him and apologized profusely. He just laughed and waved his hand in blessing the way he always did. And he was very sweet and very bubbly. So my initial reaction in that instance was fear. And that allowed me to see the side of the guru that is just this pure and unencumbered love that bubbles forth very naturally. Guruji also shared this story about Baba. Another time, I was walking along the breezeway between two buildings at the South Fallsburg, New York ashram. I heard this yelling coming from one of the conference rooms, and I realized it was Muktananda I was hearing. He was just yelling and screaming at the people who were there. He was really letting them have it, and he was not happy. I considered leaving because I didn't know what he was going to be like when he came out of that room, but I was there already, and I just froze. When he came out, he was just glowing, effervescent, bubbling with bliss. So you could say that I got to see both sides of the guru at that time. But the guru doesn't really have separate sides the way we think of it. His internal state never changes. Everything the guru does is teaching. The various sides are just him or her expressing their teaching in the manner that is appropriate based on what is going on around them. So the guru is fierce and unconditionally loving at the same time. Both are grace. After that, the people who were being yelled at came out, and they were obviously very affected. Bliss. It's like the stories of Baba's guru, Nityananda. as the stories go, Nityananda used to throw wooden sandals at people. Those who were hit by a sandal would immediately go into samadhi. Samadhi is a state of absorption. So evidently, as a teacher of mine used to say, every knock is a boost. That is, in being hit by the sandal, you learned what was appropriate to learn, but it also sent you into bliss. So the pain was actually love and sent you into a blissful state. Kindly allow this, Swami, to expand a bit here. This Swami has had the great fortune of experiencing quite a number of knocks that in the moment it's happening do not seem fun at all, but when the reason for the knock becomes clear, it's bliss. It is just bliss. And it takes a while to get used to this because, you know, as humans, we prefer that which we find pleasurable and want to avoid that which is not. But see, the work of the guru is to expose you to the full spectrum and the objective of enlightenment and liberation is to achieve non-attachment and non-aversion, where you can witness anything. Now, the mind itself, the outwardly focused individuated mind, will most certainly have a reaction, a thought pattern, a process associated with whatever it is that is seen or experienced. Okay? But that only lasts a very short time. And that's okay too, because even when you are fully enlightened and liberated, you are doing the great cosmic balancing act of being everything while being individuated and outwardly focused at the same time. And this is rather difficult. Verse 149 and 150, Shiva said to Parvati, "O Parvati, the guru will protect the disciple from the curses of gods, saints, and even from snakes." You could also understand this as the reptile part of the brain. The guru will protect them from fear of death as well. The gods and the saints are powerless to offer protection anywhere to one who has been cursed by the guru. Verse 151. Shiva said to Parvati, "The word guru is the king of all the mantras. This indeed is the essence of the Vedas, the Smritis, and the Puranas." The commentary. Other discourses and philosophies are only more intricate than this verse because people tend to make things more complicated than they need to be. The Guru Mantra, which one is initiated into, is the highest mantra. The guru path is the highest path. It is complete in and of itself. No other path is complete without guru. One need not know anything more than this. One need not know even this much, actually. So long as the guru is served and adored, self-realization is the result. Let's take our bottom of the hour break song, and we will be back with verse 152 here on Meditative Living. Namaste and blessings. Welcome back to Meditative Living with your most fortunate host, Swami Shivananda Giri. Let us continue. Verse 152. Shiva said to Parvati, "One who wears ochre-colored clothes and holds a stick for the sake of honor, respect, and worship is not a renunciate. Only he who is intent, or she who is intent on seeking pure knowledge, is a renunciate." The commentary. Many people are eager to make pronouncements and parrot injunctions purportedly dictating what a swami, which is the title of a renunciant, is or isn't. It is true that a swami tends to wear orange or red robes. The Swami wears red. And to carry a stick and or some other types of paraphernalia. There are certain vows that they tend to take, certain observances that they tend to keep. As the original Guru Gita is kind enough to point out, however, there is really only one criterion that makes one's designation as a renunciant accurate or inaccurate. One who is intent on seeking pure, capital K, knowledge is a renunciant and nobody else. Kindly allow this Swami to expand here. The pursuit of this knowledge is not like an outwardly focused education as we understand that to be in today's world. It is not something that should result in a bunch of doubt and confusion about anything. This is something entirely different. This knowledge is full and stable. Nothing is the same again. You very clearly see, understand, and can function in both the position of the all and the position of the individuated unit of consciousness. Both at the same time. Okay? And it's not something that is simple to achieve. Verse number 153, Shiva said to Parvati, only those who understand the truth, capital T, through service rendered unto the Guru, are said to be true renunciants. All others are mere imposters. The commentary. Some people wear the uniform, but this means nothing if one isn't drawn to the capital S self, like a moth is drawn to a flame. Like the moth, the renunciate is so in love with the very light of consciousness, that he or she is not only willing, but also compelled to give up the lower S self to become one with this light. Quote, the guru is the means, end quote, says the Shiva Sutras, another ancient text, a sentiment echoed in this verse. These are the hallmarks of the real Swamis and nothing else. The true renunciant is in love with God. Thus, they find bliss at the feet of the guru in both the literal and the figurative sense. Verse 154, Shiva said to Parvati, whoever realizes that formless, attributeless Brahman, who is of the nature of truth and bliss, who is a mass of pure consciousness, this is the person who is suited to perform the role of guru. Verse 155, Shiva said to Parvati, by the grace of the Guru, by seeing the big S, self, within oneself, by the path of liberation, and by effort directed toward perceiving oneness, one will attain self, big S, knowledge, self-knowledge, enlightenment. Verse 156, Shiva said to Parvati, from Brahman on down to a pillar, all forms, mobile and immobile alike, are pervaded by God only. To that one, I offer my salutations. Verse 157. Shiva said to Parvati, I salute the Guru who is existence, consciousness, bliss, known in Sanskrit as Sat Chitananda, beyond emotions, teacher to the world, ever abiding in the big S, self. He or she is eternal, perfect, formless, and free from attributes. Verse 158. Shiva says to Parvati, one should always meditate on the Supreme, who is eternal, who is the bestower of happiness, and who shines in the heart space like a pure crystal. Verse 159, Shiva says to Parvati, just as a crystal is reflected in another crystal, or a mirror is reflected in another mirror, likewise, in all beings, consciousness, bliss, is shining forth as I am. Verse 160. Shiva says to Parvati, O Parvati, I will tell you about the experience that arises in one upon meditating on the Supreme as the consciousness abiding in the space of the heart. The commentary. The heart spoken of here is neither the physical organ that pumps blood for the body, nor is it the astral body's energy processing center, which roughly corresponds to the same part of the body known as the Anahata chakra, or the heart chakra. The word translated here as heart is Hridaya. Alternatively, Hridaya. In this context, the word heart means the center, the core, the essence, the best, or the most secret part of anything. Thus, the heart is where one finds consciousness, because the heart is consciousness alone. The two words are synonymous. The conscious, big S, self, is not an anatomical feature. Time, space, and all other phenomena emanate from consciousness, not the other way around. When all of these cease to exist, consciousness is what they are reabsorbed into. That Shiva, as we may also elect to call it, is ever present and remains completely unaltered and unaffected both by the presence and the absence of phenomena alike. The heart is in your chest, sure, but that is only because it is everywhere all times. How then can the big S self be said to be limited to any particular size, whether that is the size of a mustard seed or however much space the universe takes up. Various scriptures have described consciousness in all of these terms. At the same time, it has been described as smaller than the smallest, greater than the greatest, and subtler than the subtlest. Again, emphasizing the complete and utter inability to categorize consciousness as anything other than the essence of everything that exists, and that which persists even in the absence of the entire created order of things. Again, this begs the question, why talk about it in terms of size at all? The answer is that each specific description highlights a particular aspect of consciousness that can be contemplated and or acted upon in a certain way in order to help the seeker experience the conscious self beyond the mind. In other words, the mind, correctly utilized, helps one transcend the mind and the personhood limitation that it implies. These descriptions can help one to begin utilizing their mind in this way. When Jesus described the kingdom as both a mustard seed, the smallest of seeds, and an enormous tree, he was effectively giving an excellent description of the various characteristics of consciousness as nirguna, or formless, and saguna, with form. Smaller than the smallest, greater than the greatest. Thus, consciousness is the entirety of the universe, but also none of it. Everything, yet no thing. In acquiring this conceptual framework, the human mind comes to understand the nature of consciousness about as much as is capable of doing so. Contemplation of this constitutes self-inquiry and is one of the yogic means that is taught for the sake of leading seekers through the direct experience of self, with a big S, which again is beyond the sphere of the mind. The phenomenon of consciousness being described is a recurring theme in yogic literature and, in a sense, is a different animal entirely. In these instances, it is sometimes described as being blue in color, sometimes white, sometimes the detail of its color is omitted. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna is seen by a sage while still in the womb as a blue light about the size of a thumb, clothed in yellow robes. The Katha Upanishad describes the soul as a flame the size of one's thumb. In this light, it is clear that the reason Krishna is traditionally portrayed as blue-skinned and clad in yellow robes is that he is being equated to the soul, or the self. However, the scriptures are much more tight-lipped about the reason that consciousness is described in these terms in the first place. In the spiritual autobiography of Swami Muktananda, Baba describes a series of light phenomena that he experienced over the course of his sadhana, Sadhana means practice. He experienced four different colors of light, each smaller than the next. The first and largest was a red light, the size of his own body. This light corresponded to the physical body. The second light was white, the size of his thumb, and corresponded to the astral body. The third light was black, the size of his fingertip, and corresponded to the causal body. The fourth and final light was blue, the size of a lentil, and corresponded to the supra-causal body. Baba refers to the blue light as the blue pearl. It also corresponds to Paramashiva and to the Bindu of the Sri Yantra. Baba says that he became fully and permanently self-realized when he merged into the blue pearl, became one with it, and consequently came to see that light everywhere, in everything and everyone, prior to perceiving their individuated nature. Thus, we can see that the significance of the attribution of the color blue to consciousness has to do with a very universal spiritual experience which corresponds to the student catching a glimpse of his or her own inner divinity. The discrepancy between the size of the blue light in Baba's account and that of the Srimad Bhagavatam can easily be reconciled by simply noting that size is one of the attributes that accompanies the phenomenon of blue light, while understanding that the specific size may appear different from one seeker to the next or one instance to the next. At the risk of beating a dead horse, I feel that it is worth reiterating that consciousness isn't limited to any particular size. My experience corroborates the assertion that the blue light, which is a manifestation of consciousness, is not necessarily limited to any particular size. I have seen the blue pearl in meditation as a brilliant light, roughly the size of a lentil, as described by Muktananda, and as the size of my thumb on other occasions. Additionally, I have perceived it in the course of mundane activities, like walking and driving, as so large it filled the entire sky. Of course, the sky is always blue, but this blue light, while being soft and cool, shines with a brilliance and depth that surpasses and makes it immediately distinguishable from the color of the sky. The yellow of Krishna's robes wasn't one of the inner experiences shared by Muktananda. Others have reported seeing a yellow-colored subtle body in meditation, though. One source places that body between the red color and the white-colored subtle body. The topic of subtle phenomena comes up again later. They could be discussed here in much more detail, but this could actually become counterproductive. These phenomena are not an end in themselves and can actually become a distraction. They're worth pointing out insofar as they prepare the seeker so that he or she isn't frightened or otherwise distracted any more than is necessary. Let that sink in for a moment. The scriptures have endeavored toward this end in various ways. Generally speaking, the matter is only alluded to briefly and or is presented in some form of code or another, as exemplified in this verse and the portion of the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Katha Upanishad, that I have cited. Historically speaking, these cryptic utterances have generally been left to the guru to elaborate upon as he or she deems appropriate. As far as I am aware, Swami Muktananda is the first adept to really set out the meaning of these phenomena to the general public, and this has only occurred in modern times. Thank you ever so much for allowing this Swami to be of service. If you should wish to contact this Swami with a question, comment, complaint, or anything else, just go to Swami, swami.info. And you will find all sorts of stuff, and you will find this Swami's email contact. Again, thank you ever so much for sitting with this Swami today, or doing whatever it is you may be doing. We will kick it off again next week, perhaps, with verse number 161 from the authoritative Guru Gita. Namaste and blessings. Om Namo Narayana.